is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 29, and I'm joined by Falgunis Sheth, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Political Theory at Hampshire College. She is also another fellow graduate of the New School for Social Research to join me on The Digital Dialogue. Emma Bianchi joined me for episode 24, and later on this afternoon, Rick Lee will be joining me for episode 30. Mm-hmm. So Falgunis has published numerous articles on social, political philosophy, continental philosophy, legal theory, and subaltern and gender studies. She is the co-editor of Race, Liberalism, and Economics, published by University of Michigan Press in 2004. But she's here today to talk about her compelling new book, Toward a Political Philosophy of Race, published by SUNY Press in 2009. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to The Digital Dialogue.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah. It's great to actually have this conversation after our collegial relationship in grad school so many years ago.
It's fun to come back together after all this time. We see each other at conferences and things. And I was really happy to see this book and to have a chance to read it. One of the great things about doing The Digital Dialogue is I get to read great books and talk to their authors. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to read it. So maybe you could begin by talking a little bit about what you're trying to do in the book and what the book, sort of the basic structure of it for those who haven't read it. We'll have links on the blog page to it. So make sure people get it. But give us a sense of things.
Okay, well, you know, as we were talking about a little bit before, it's a little bit like, waking up from and going, wait, what was that thing that that I was thinking about? It feels a little bit like a dream. But when I actually started writing it right after 9/11, which was about 4 months after I finished the degree. Mm-hmm. And 9/11 kind of marked my teaching career. Mm-hmm. And, marked actually my teaching career at Hampshire College, which is an interdisciplinary place. And I was really kind of curious about this very interesting divide between continental philosophy and political philosophy, which, in fact, is not thought of as kind of part of the tradition of continental philosophy. Right. You know, it's thought of as separate because continental philosophy is about metaphysics and ontology and epistemology, but somehow not political philosophy. Right. And then again, the divide between each of those and just various discourses on race.
Right.
And philosophy of race. And interestingly enough, I mean, we're certainly seeing a lot more of this now, but philosophy of race, again, seems to somehow be separate from political philosophy.
Yeah.
So I was kind of interested in bringing all of these together because I read in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed like there was a kind of disjunct in terms of certain kinds of conversations, even as each of these traditions appeared to have common interests.
Right.
But the literatures were not speaking to each other.
Right.
And at least I was taking seriously as my premise that, that in fact, you know, we're not all doing such radical work that there is, you know, such disjunctive radical work, you know, literally going to the roots of things that we can't speak with each other. And so my worry is that we're reproducing certain kinds of insights and not benefiting from the insights of other folks who are answering these questions in other traditions.
Right.
So I wanted to bring them together.
Well, you did a great job on that. I mean, I really feel like the you can see the trajectory and how the different vocabularies and the different conceptual schemes of the traditions are really enriched by the dialogue that you have, I think, performed in the book. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the sort of structure, because you sort of begin with Heidegger, kind of, and technology, at least, except for you've done this interesting thing by substituting the word race for some of the Heidegger's use of technology. Maybe we could start by talking about that and race and technology because I think the logic that you sort of lay out there about how race is, there's a dimension of concealment in this and how there's a naturalizing of race in a certain kind of way. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's, you know, interestingly enough, it's probably that chapter is the first article that I ever published, but it's not what I started.
Mm.
I mean, as we know, we tend to write our books out of sequence, right?
Right.
And so I actually started with much more concrete issues having to do with Muslims in the aftermath of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think about this as I was reading about race and race literatures, and was really frustrated that it was difficult to talk about what appeared to me to be a kind of racializing of a range of groups, and yet so little literature, so that race ended up kind of, you know, really in some sense being identified with a black-white binary.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it became difficult, and in fact really kind of certain kinds of racial presences were being displaced through language, right, like religion and right, culture. And it seemed to me that the phenomena were really similar. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I mean, as often happens, I mean, my writing ends up being influenced by the things that I teach. I happen right, to be teaching Question Concerning Technology uh-huh. at a point when I was writing and reading about this, thinking about this phenomenon. And so it was literally that first, the paragraph, right, that
right,
about technology being concealed and that the essence of technology is not the same as technology. And it suddenly struck me that that was exactly the place where I wanted to kind of shake up some mm-hmm. kind of conceptual assumptions about race and mm-hmm. to say, well, actually, often that thing, the thing in itself is, or the appearance of a thing is not the thing in itself, right? So this is really our continental
right,
background kind of coming well, back to it. And so a lot right, of Kant, right? Also.
And I mean, what I liked about sort of what you did there was that, and I think this is part of Heidegger's point about technology, is it's always working on us in a way, even when we're not thematizing it as working on us. So that's that which is always operating. But really, you need to sort of figure out about how to get back behind that and,
exactly,
and make it explicit and articulate it in terms that allow you to reflect upon it. And I mean, I think if I'm understanding the one thrust of the argument, it part of your solution that you point to, at least at the end, is that it's in part about recognizing the way that that racialization is performed mm-hmm. in a certain way, although that's not really your language; it's more produced, maybe, as mm-hmm. would be your language.
I think that's right.
Right, because the vocabulary, or at least, so maybe we could talk about this idea of race as involving division, dividing,
okay,
right? Because mm-hmm. I think that was a that's part of this point that you were making, namely that, let me see if I had, that race as a vehicle for division. I wanted mm-hmm. to get that right, the right, mm-hmm. right. So maybe, how is that, well, let's stop there with race as a vehicle for division.
Okay, so I actually want to kind of go back
yeah.
a little bit to your prior
okay.
question, because I think it bridges into this.
Okay.
Which is to say, you know, Heidegger's notion of Gestell
yeah.
was really helpful for me. I mean, in terms of thinking, again, of, you know, the way in which we take the language of race at face value. So, for
right.
example, there's a really good series on PBS called Race, the Power of an Illusion,
mm-hmm.
which I tend to, you know, show in a number of my different courses. But, you know, one of the first volume talks about kind of race as, it tries to basically get very vividly the point across about race as a social construction. And so it shows
right.
all kinds of different people who look really different.
Right.
And so the message that you walk away with is that race is somehow misread, but it's about skin color.
Right.
And it's about a certain kind of essence. And we know that it's not that. And yet, it just seemed like the kind of... that there's a certain, you know, Heidegger's discussion of Gestell kind of helps us think about the ways in which, as you say, we are enveloped
mm-hmm.
in a certain framework
mm-hmm.
with a certain Weltanschauung that we ourselves cannot escape.
Right.
Right. And so it becomes really difficult to
right.
kind of stand back.
Right.
And so just to take a kind of historical view, I mean, you know, to think about the race not so much as a thing, but as a mode.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, that's
mm-hmm.
that to me struck me as a much
mm-hmm.
more productive way of thinking about it, and also one which suddenly now allows me to think about the structural foundations
right.
of race,
right.
right?
Right.
Rather than thinking about race as an identity
mm-hmm.
that applies to different people, right?
Right.
But there's no kind of metaphysics there,
right.
if you will.
But I mean, if I understand what you argue in the book, you're really part of what you're interested in, okay, in later chapters, we're now still sort of focusing on this early chapter, but in later chapter is the way racialization is deployed by sovereign authority,
yeah.
right, in order to control, divide, and to sort of protect, right, the in from the out, the citizen from mm-hmm. the pariah. Mm-hmm. Now I know you do use
and the whole time kind of language. Doing it in the language of justice.
Yes. Well, that's okay. So maybe we should just go right to the heart of the critique of liberalism, which I totally was loving reading about. Right. So yeah, I mean the whole book could be read. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong as a radical critique of liberalism.
Well, you know, and that's certainly the blurb in the back of the cover. I'm like, really?
Gosh,
is that how people?
Don't
know. Well, I was really surprised too, in a way. But
it is. I mean,
it is.
Yeah, sure.
It is in
just
a way, but it's
it.
Also okay. All right, I'm taking it to heart. But it's also a kind of it's a critique of polities, right? It's a critique of sovereign subject relations.
Yeah.
And again, liberalism ends up being the term that we use for all good societies,
right?
And then we have illiberal societies.
Than you and me.
In the words of Rawls, right? So
yes,
there's illiberal societies, and then there are liberal societies,
mm-hmm.
and then there are totalitarian regimes, which are, you know, corruptions of liberal societies.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, if in fact we take those two to be identical, then it's absolutely, it's a critique of liberal societies.
Yeah.
But like I said, I mean, I think it's a critique of even just the argument that there's some notion of justice,
mm-hmm.
which underlies, right, the relationship between sovereign and subject. In liberalism, it's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy to go there in a way because the rhetoric of liberalism, the logic of liberalism is that it's supposed to represent the interests of an entire populace, right? So there's also the question of who the we is.
Right.
Well, and Schmitt, you know, Carl Schmitt takes mm-hmm. this on beautifully by mm-hmm. saying, well, actually, you can only have a we when you have a they.
Right.
And except that he often really talks about it in terms of external enemies.
Right.
And I wanted to really bring it back because part of the rhetoric of liberalism is that we have a protective safeguard, namely the framework of universal rights.
Right.
And as long as we have that, we can make an argument that liberal societies function best when they serve the interests of justice.
Right.
So if that's the case, then why is it that there are so many moments in fact, I would argue continuously, in fact, where you have these severe corruptions of that, even as the framework of universal rights are being put forth. And so we go into Iraq and talk about human rights.
Right.
We go, you know, we detain Muslims and terrorists, you know, on the grounds that we're protecting our society.
Mm-hmm.
So literally these two practices operate side by side.
Right.
So that's... Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I think what's powerful, I mean, there's a couple things you brought up there that I was really compelled by. One is this exceptionalism point that you make, which is that, you know, well, when we Western liberal powers do these things, well, it's a kind of an exception, it's accidental, and you are really challenging us to say, well, maybe there's something essential going on, or at least fundamental to what it means to be a liberal society based on the traditional values of liberalism, the value of a kind of sameness, namely equality, individual rights, and all of these, this kind of logic that we're all so familiar with and that at least on the surface seems to be in the interest of all things good and just, right? But you show that, you know, actually the way in which it operates is to divide and to maintain and to use Foucault's term, discipline, right? And to protect. So this vocabulary of security. I thought I do want to go to talk about the border populations and all that at some point. But I'd actually like to focus a second on something that I found really interesting, and it's maybe related to some of the things I've been thinking about recently. We'll see. Is this issue of the we and whether there is an essential violence. I mean, you talk about the we as at one point, is exclusion essential to the we, right? And you know, that's where the whole discussion of exceptionalism and everything come in. But I'm interested in that because maybe it's just maybe I need to just shift that slightly. It's related to this, which is what you call the unruly. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the unruly as a concept. I know I shifted you a little bit, but I think we can get back to this we question through the unruly, maybe. Okay. I'll try. I'll see if we can. If I can't, then we'll figure it.
Okay. I mean, let me just start by saying this much. I mean, you know, that you're right to kind of shift to the unruly, because in some sense that is the other side of the we.
Yeah.
But the unruly is not necessarily a designated population, right? It's a lightning rod by which to in some sense, by which there's this kind of inexorable moving towards, well, what is it that is scary and threatening? Right. And that ends up kind of like a cloud enveloping a certain population. And so it can shift. It shifts constantly. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that African Americans were the unruly, right? When mm-hmm. they... In the 17th century, the mid 18th century, mm-hmm. you know, when we have this kind of fully designated institution of slavery, that they are the unruly,
right.
and they continue to be, and which is not to say suddenly that we have no race problem, right? Mm-hmm. It's, mm-hmm. we are not living in a post-racial nation.
I
beg to disagree with that statement. But then I also think that, you know, there are ways in which that operates multiplicitously, right?
Right. So sure.
In different, with regard to different groups at the same time. So the unruly is that which is terrifying as, right. In some way. It's a threat to the kind of cohesive self-understanding of a community, mm-hmm. of a population, in Foucault's terms, but really of a community.
Right.
Like, that this is unseating something.
Right.
I mean, the thing is that, you know, Charles Mills, Shannon Sullivan, a number of other folks in ethnic studies and history talk about, you know, this in a very concrete contemporary term as white privilege.
Right.
Well, you know, so again, this is like my attempt to kind of translate part of, you know, it's like, okay, so what's unseating our security? Right?
So,
what's unseating our sense of how of how things come together cohesively.
Right. So, let me see if I can... So one of the things that I've been working on, and it's related to this sort of book project I've been working on, Truth and Aristotle, and I was thinking about this in more ontological terms, which you might not buy into, but I'm wondering if something like this would be at work here. And what I'm thinking of is that in that book, I'm trying to argue that there is part of everything that exists. It is understandable to some degree, but there's always what I call a dimension of unicity, or a dimension that is elusive to categorization, conceptualization, rationalization, understandability in everything that exists. So I want to make it a really very broad ontological kind of claim, mm-hmm. that says that everything can be understood in some ways to some degree, but never totally, right? Mm-hmm. So this is sort of and that's the dimension of the what I would call singularity of everything has a dimension of singularity, which is this obstreperous, recalcitrant, I would say unruly dimension. Now, we humans have a tendency, I think, to, in the face of that, and this is something that, you know, I think Dick Bernstein sort of taught, at least me at the New School, was, you know, there's this Cartesian anxiety when you're faced with the unknown, you posit, you know, some foundation.
Right.
I think something like that's happening, and I'm wondering if what I'm trying to call unicity and singularity and that which is uncooptable,
mm-hmm.
Is related to this notion of the unruly, and that we would, and then part, I think, you know, what I found compelling about what you said, and what I myself also think, is that part of the point is to recognize our relation to what I would call the unicity or singularity, what I would also be happy to call the unruly, and how are we encountering that and allowing that to hold us accountable for the things that we do. I don't know if that's fair to bring that your vocabulary into sort of some of my conceptual framework, but and the reason why I wonder if you might doubt it is because I'm being a little bit too ontological or something. I'm making a kind of example.
I mean, obviously, I would love to have us discuss it more, but right now, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I certainly think that this is an ontology.
Yeah.
There is an ontological dimension that even I'm trying to kind of get to, not quite, you know, not quite as purely as I think the language that you're using, but certainly. I mean, you know, it's also... I was smiling when you were describing this because there are so many things going through my head, but one of them is, you know, it's the irrational.
Yeah.
It's about...
It's the mad, but it's... Right.
It's madness.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And I also kind of have this element of madness that I like to talk about.
Well, actually, that brings me to a slightly different point, but we can talk about it, because you don't use the notion... You don't use the vocabulary of neuroses and things. I had Noelle McAfee on the Digital Dialogue a few sessions back, and, you know, she's all about the using the psychoanalytic vocabulary to get at something I think that's very similar to what you're trying to point out. But we don't have to go there at the moment, but...
Well, it is interesting, though. I mean, like, the psychoanalytic moment. My students are trying to beat me into, reading it and kind of and addressing it. But, I mean, yeah, I think there absolutely is something there. My worry, of course, is, and I think it's probably a misguided worry, but I'm not quite sure how to get past it yet. I just need to read some more. My worry is that it also ends up kind of devolving into this kind of evolutionary biology language, which troubles me.
Yeah,
right?
I can see being troubled by it. Yeah.
And so that's why I've kind of stayed away from it. This idea that there's something kind of primordial about it. I don't know if it is or not. I know that that's what we see, but I also worry about the problem of induction there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what are we... You know, what kinds of conclusions are we making, which are may or may not be well grounded, and so that's why. I also just think that, you know, political philosophy is really impoverished in terms of a vocabulary to describe this phenomenon, which appears to be unfortunately reoccurring and ubiquitous.
Well, it's operating at all times, as you're saying. And in this sense, I think you're exactly right. It's always operating. We're always responding to it, but we're very rarely aware of ourselves as responding to it. We may be doing things. And actually, I think if this dimension of the unruly is operating all the time, on the one hand, I would want to avoid us making that a kind of universal, characteristic of everything. But on the other hand, I think there is a sense in which the human condition is conditioned by this limit that we understand, be it intellectually or in an embodied way, or it just comes out in these ways. And there's a tendency. And I think that's what you're trying to parse out in some ways in this book is to, or maybe I can put it this way, that racialization is a way of responding to that unruliness.
Yes.
And it is, I would say, a neurotic way to use the psychoanalytic language, but I'm happy to use other kinds of language. It's a self-destructive way. One of the things that I'm really interested in thinking about... a different kind of project on Greek tragedy and these moments of sovereignty and sacrifice that happen when Agamemnon sacrifices Iphigenia, and there's there's this moment of denial, and that moment of denial is, I think, that recognition of the moment of what Rainer Schirmann would call singularity, where the double bind is operating on you.
I think that's right, and I think, I mean, you know, this is also part of, I mean, it's really, you put it very beautifully, because as you're talking, I'm just reading it through the lens of some of the arguments that I made here. And part of what's important for me is to bring it back to concrete politics.
Right.
Right. So what you say is absolutely ever present in these kinds of repetitive debates over immigration.
Right.
And assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that in philosophy, we tend to also have these kinds of... You know, these subfields where we talk about whether, you know, assimilation is a good thing or a bad thing. And then I just think, wow, what a question.
Right.
You know, that to me, that is part of exactly this need to suppress, you know, divide, mm-hmm. to kind of subsume and, in some sense, to kind of to bring a population to its knees, as it were.
Right.
At the risk of being thrown out of the gates of the city.
Right. And, I mean, you do a nice job also of thinking about ontological categories and how they operate. So the whole process of categorization is, I think, bound up with this desire to tame the untamed. Or
yeah.
the unruly in your vocabulary. So
and so there's something dialectical. I mean, to me, yeah. I think that's a much better kind of language than inevitability. I think that there's a dialectic there, right? Which, along with, you know, it's funny how you know people, you know, Kant's big thing about how one can read Plato better than, you know, Plato reads himself.
Right.
But somebody said to me at one point, they're like, well, wait a minute, you know. Didn't you read a lot of Hegel in grad school? And I was like, oh my God, that's right. I mean, there is this kind of element of irrationality that has to be subsumed.
Yeah.
And then, as history performs its kind of teleological drive.
So what, I mean, so where would you go with that? I mean, if that's the vocabulary that you want to use, and I'm okay with using it, well, maybe then you are, maybe is that where this border population and mediation in that third term?
Probably. I mean, I like the threes of Hegel. What can I say?
Yeah. But I mean, but you don't
I think
like,
it's helpful. I mean, it's not indulgent for me to use it. I think it's.
Look, we come from the same place.
So, right.
So I'm totally with you. But you won't, you wouldn't, I assume that you wouldn't adopt the idea of, you know, this mediation that is somehow closable somehow, right? Because that is the power of the negative in Hegel is what drives the system, but isn't that exactly what you're problematizing? Namely, that it's not just the tarrying with the negative, to use Hegel's language, but it is the way in which sovereign power deploys categories and power to repress the negative, the untamed, and to exclude it and to cut it off. And yet it always finds itself implicated by it, and that's what then repeats these.
But this is also Hegel, right? So
yeah.
then in the next moment, I mean, no matter how, you know, how successful that moment of kind of sublation and how Aufhebung is, you're moving to the next moment. Something is kind of then reappearing,
right
in the next form, in order for the next tension to kind of come back, right? So there is a kind of negation.
But
there.
I mean, Hegel is fine. I mean, that's the engine
I'm
of
not,
his system.
I'm not insisting that one should read this through the lens of Hegel.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, for the record.
Yeah, exactly.
I totally understand what you're saying, but so then what happens
but
with you? What about Tina? What about you?
A naturalizing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's also part of...
Right,
so it's literally... So, I mean, it's in the same kind of complicated dialectic, right? The dialectic has so many different forms here. I mean, you've got kind of... Platonic dialectic,
right.
Then you've got this other, you know, I guess to come back to Hegel, I don't want to now, but
it will suck you back in.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, there are multiple dimensions there. So there's the dimension of the unruly, right? And then there's also the level of sovereign power and how sovereign authorities attempt to deal with it.
Right.
So there's multiple layers of dialectic.
Right.
You know,
but I mean, my sense of what you're trying to get us to think about at the end of the book is to be cognizant and self-aware of that of that process, so that we can perhaps, and I think you gestured to this, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of attempt to minimize the kind of violence that gets operated. I don't think you have the kind of naive stance that we could get rid of violence. I think we've read enough Derrida to recognize that. So let me ask you that as a question. Is this right? It's a question of minimizing. It's not a question of deluding yourself to think that we could get into this, you know, kind of peace, total peace kind of.
Yeah, and right? I think probably this is the place where I really am a philosopher, right? I mean, I just think, you know, to talk about solutions before one has figured out the problem and whether or not one has kind of figured out the proper framework.
Right.
Is often quite destructive, right? So, I mean, in terms of solutions, I mean, I guess that's why I go there, because I'm not sure what a solution is, but it seems to me that that self-consciousness, self-awareness right. is kind of a big first step. And part of that self-awareness is precisely to shift one's lens and to say, it's not accidental.
Right.
There are no accidents, right?
Right. We're colluding in this. Yeah, we, and I mean now me, white male, are colluding in this kind of process. And to the point in which we don't recognize that and don't take stock of that is how it can get... It has been, for example, in the logic of liberalism, you know, couched in terms of justice and rights and all these things, which allegedly seem good, but that if we're not thinking about how this play cashes itself out in reality, we are all right. You're looking not happy about something that I just said.
No, I mean, I'm just thinking. I mean, part of it is also, you know, it's funny because it still shocks me at a certain level. I mean, I'm, you know, to kind of particularize it in the language of white males.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's kind of making me, you know, I'm perfectly fine with a lot of the language of white supremacy as being a really important framework you know, and white privilege, et cetera. But here, I also think that there's a kind of disservice in the sense, by particularizing it to that moment, in the sense that, you know, it's a discourse.
Mm-hmm.
It's a discourse, which means, you know, and it's a hegemonic discourse, right?
So what is talking about white male?
Well, no, or no, just white the language and black. Of justice.
I see.
And the language,
right?
So it's not so much that it's white males perpetuating it. Certainly, absolutely, historically speaking, we can speak in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a language that many of us who, you know, that we subscribe to,
sure.
either optimistically
right.
or hopefully,
right.
and I too,
yeah.
you know, but also that that it's a kind of collective collusion,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
and I guess I'm having trouble with the language because in a way it's not just a collective collusion, but it's an institutionalization of how we understand history,
mm-hmm.
and an institutionalization of how we understand politics, so that when we look at aberrations or deviations, when we look at the internment of the Japanese,
right.
when we look at the Chinese Exclusion Act, when we look at the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
we think of these as singular events,
right, right. Right. Yeah.
And that, to me, is part of the institutionalization of acceptability.
Right.
Right? Right. That even as we reproduce our students.
Right.
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 That there has to be a certain kind of vocabulary and a certain institutional perspective that
right.
we instill in them to mm-hmm. carry on.
Right.
Right. Right. And so that's. That's
right.
a huge, I mean, I talk about that in the
yeah.
introduction. I mean, that's
yeah.
a huge worry for me
right.
because it's also about, you know, the kind of the language of recognition and the language of acceptability.
Right.
Who gets
right.
a job? Who gets a voice? Who
mm-hmm.
gets an ear?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at what point do we decide that somebody is really being radical or they're just being a crackpot?
Right.
When we talk about the epistemology of injustice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think what you're pointing to is the way in which language itself and the history of philosophy itself operates much like you say race operates, much like Heidegger says technology operates. It's operating always on us. We can't get outside of it. We are stuck in it. And so a strategy, one of probably multiple strategies we have to bring to bear, is to use it against itself. I mean, you use the vocabulary of the law against the law at the end,
exactly.
right? And so, you know, to be able to start doing
exactly.
that is I think, really important. And also, you know, from my perspective, I think having conversations that are sometimes difficult to have. I mean, to really call out, you know, dynamics that are operating,
mm-hmm.
You know, between people. And
it's funny because I'm giving a talk in 2 weeks on the language of white liberal racism.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it was just, I'm smiling. Cause, like, yeah,
yeah.
There's some really interesting kind of conversations to be had
yeah.
there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's hard to live it because what it means is that you have to say, okay, have the trust in the other person you're talking to enough to say, look, how is race operating in this conversation? Or how is... A certain kind of history informing our vocabulary and closing us off from other possible ways of thinking about them.
Yeah, I think that's you're right, Chris, but I also think that there's something fundamental to this conversation that I have yet to figure out a definitive answer to. And again, people in ethnic studies and critical race theory are writing about this, feminist theory are writing about this, but it's not just the difficult conversations. There's also the question of the fundamental inequality of power.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And the kind of the concealment of that power, right? In the language of, well, we're just equals, or
right. In
the language of, of getting jobs, mm-hmm. and working with dissertation advisors. And I've got some friends who, really interesting, but they talk about, they're academics, academics of color, I guess, mm-hmm. Who talk about how their graduate students, will certainly come to them to take classes with them.
Right.
But when it comes to a dissertation, they have to go with somebody else because they have to get a job. And so they really have to learn this. And it's like, wow, okay. It's a really interesting institutionalization of which kinds of discourses are authoritative and have legitimacy.
Right. Well, there I get totally sucked into a point of despair that your comments at the very end, when you're trying, at least correct me if I'm wrong, where you're trying to sort of guard off a kind of claim of nihilism, this book isn't nihilistic. I want to talk a little bit about what led to all that, but I feel like there must have been some kind of review or something that made you think about that. But anyway, because that's not how I came. When I came around to the when you started talking about nihilism, I was like, I don't feel like this book has been nihilistic. But anyway, maybe it's because we come from the new school, and this is great. The point that you made at the end, which was really in the way heartening, but also hard, is it's little things. It's in little acts of, now I would use the vocabulary of justice, but not in the traditional liberal sense of justice, but little acts of resistance, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's how you put it at the end, that mean things, and over time maybe can begin to turn the tide a little bit. But on the other hand, let's not be naive and Pollyannish about it. I mean, we can build all kinds of we can do all kinds of little acts that are, but it's a huge institutional, cultural, societal thing that has to be moved.
I think that's right. And I also think that this idea of a utopia, there's something very messianic about it. And, it feels like it's at odds with this notion of, to come back to Heidegger, to come back to Deleuze, to come back to Nietzsche, with this notion of kind of dynamics in history, mm-hmm. of a certain kind of temporality, of mm-hmm. a certain kind of, it's not quite clear that every single moment in society is like this. It's not, right? And so there are always ways of engaging in resistance and certain, kind of shifting, sidestepping, there's, as the Gestalt changes, right, as the epic changes, there's, mm-hmm. There are new versions of this phenomenon, and then there are other pockets that are somewhat safer. And so there is something, dynamic about it. So to think about just solving it at once, there's a very monochromatic response there.
Yeah. Well, and it may be part of being caught up in a kind of logic of liberalism and a larger logic of utopian thinking. But actually, that's one of the reasons why I'm trying to do some thinking about the way Socrates practices politics, because he refuses to take power.
Yeah.
And he infuses every discussion he has with this orientation toward, what might it mean to be just, right? And good. And I think as ideals, now they can certainly be deployed within a logic of authoritarian discipline. But what I find compelling in some ways, at least if we look at how Socrates practices politics in some of the dialogues, is, and also how I would like this podcast to operate, and also some of my research, is to have conversations and have a real exchange of ideas that are asking these kinds of questions and pushing us toward something new, toward new possibilities without being a utopian about it, right? Because we're going to be able to move in some direction, but it's not going to be everything fixed, you know, right? I mean, as you were saying, I mean, it drives me crazy too, this post-racial stuff. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Can we go back to, since you were talking about the concrete, I really like to talk a little bit more about the veil, the whole veil example that you used in the book.
Okay. Not the veil of ignorance.
No, well, you did a nice play with that on the veil of ignorance. Uh-huh. The funniest thing was, as you were going on about the veil, and then you brought Rawls, and I'm like, I think, you know, what about the veil of ignorance? And then I read the next paragraph, there's the veil of ignorance. I was like, yeah, she did it. Yeah, good job. So talk about how that example operates in the book, because I like the way it really concretizes what you're trying, this phenomenon of mm-hmm. racialization.
Okay.
If you can remember.
But yeah, I know. Coming out of my dream a little bit. Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to me because I still have the same conversations that I was having 7-8 years ago about the hijab. It really epitomizes part of the process of racialization that I'm trying to argue for in my book, because the veil is for me an example of the unruly. Mm-hmm. Right, it is an example of, you know, the unruly is not a person. It's some sign. It's mm-hmm. an accent or a comportment, you know, or something which is a kind of, you know, I use the term floating signifier mm-hmm. in the book, right? But something that you can't quite put your finger on, and it ends up being displaced in controversies about race.
Right?
So that the language surrounding kind of women who wear the hijab, either in France, and really we haven't had as much of it in the U.S., but in Canada as well, and I guess in Italy, you know, has been, well, it's about women's freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shouldn't women be free?
Right.
So in order to have Muslim women be free, let's forbid them from wearing the veil.
Right.
You know, I mean, just something really fascinating about that. So this kind of imposition of a certain kind of cultural construction of autonomy, which is incredibly debilitating and destructive in the name of freedom, while it's really, I mean, in some sense, Muslim women then become the pawns in a struggle between the state, mm-hmm. right, or those who think of themselves on the side of the state,
mm-hmm.
whether it's feminists of a certain persuasion, or of certain kinds of liberals or politicians, who it's a struggle between them and really Muslim men, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's a struggle between Western patriarchy versus Muslim patriarchy.
Right.
You know, so there's something intensely ironic about this, because the struggle is also a racial struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one will say, well, no, we're not out, you know, no one will say, well, we're, you know, what we really hate are Muslim men and religious fundamentalists,
right?
Or they'll say, well, we're after religious fundamentalists and not really Muslim men. But in fact, you know, so what we want is religious freedom and autonomy.
Yeah.
But yet it's the hijab which ends up getting legislated.
Right.
And the thing is that the reification of it,
mm-hmm.
right, then creates this very interesting phenomenon where, you know, when you try to ask, well, what about the hijab is so problematic, right? It's, oh, well, women are covering up their bodies.
Right.
It's like, okay, and? So then what?
Well, I mean, you do a...
In a historical context, you know, we think it's really liberatory, but my mother who, you know, and I'm not Muslim, my mother would be horrified at this idea. I actually have another piece on the sari and the hijab where I kind of compare, you know, why it is that the hijab gets so much flack, but the sari does not. And it's this kind of example of glamour and being sophisticated and Goldie Hawn and Cherie Blair and Oprah and Anna Kournikova all wear the sari.
Well, but what I found so...
And cover their bodies.
Right. What I found so excellent about that whole analysis in the book was you used that as a moment to uncover why the hijab is such an affront to the economy of liberal values, right? because of the concealment, yeah. because of, oh, there's maybe more than just the words passing between us that's actually determining our relationship.
Yeah.
There's a visual dimension. I can't categorize you in certain kinds of way. Can I take you seriously or not if I can't see, you know, your body, your face, your whatever?
And
right?
it does really betray what we talk about as the currency double meaning, right? The currency of liberalism.
Right.
Just like, it's not just language. It's the tone. It's, you know, it's how I read your message.
Right.
And if I can't do that, then there's something unknown that has to, again, be overtaken by me in order to feel like I'm not being threatened again.
Right.
And so Jack Straw's, you know, just brilliant, you know, message to women who veil, you know, he was I'm now forgetting his position in Labor Secretary, was, you know, in England. But I mean, I think it was actually, I can't remember the exact title. But anyway, he asked women who came to visit him in his office to take off the hijab.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, and the reason was because, you know, because he couldn't really understand them.
Right.
And I thought, well, if they call you on the phone. Right. I mean, it's not quite clear that you understand them more or less better.
Right. But I mean, I think it also brings up, and you draw this out a little bit in the text too, is the sort of, you know, the way in which vision in some ways is operating in this liberal economy of values, and the way, you know, a certain kind of embodiment is operative, even if liberalism doesn't want to recognize it's still operating, right?
I think that's right, and that's why I always come back to this idea of comportment,
right?
You know, because it also, for example, and part of what I was interested in doing was to think about a structure of racialization that didn't just apply to Muslims, even though this is the population that one is concerned about if one lives in the U.S. often, but that also applies to African Americans or Latinos or any group of people who are, you know, in the words of Foucault, as yet unformed,
right?
But become a population precisely through the historical operation of what the new unruly is.
Right.
And so something like comportment then, I think, also helps to explain things like racial profiling.
Right. So let's go back and just touch on something that comes up really toward the end, but this whole question of border populations. And I really found that an interesting analysis, and I'd like just to hear, first of all, give a kind of summary of it, but it also helped me think a little bit about sort of under what gets called as when people start talking about a post-racial society, you know, it really is pointing in using your analysis to this way in which African Americans now do inhabit this border space as included and yet also excluded in a way that is serving as a kind of protection for a certain kind of sovereignty. So maybe you can talk
about a certain kind of dominant population,
right?
Who then is closest to sovereign authority?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, and I don't think it has to be about African Americans per se, but I think it really helps to think about race as a tripartite structure. That it's that racialization doesn't happen just through an in-group and an out-group, but a group who's somewhat ambiguous. And in a way, I'm shamelessly borrowing from Arendt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do give her credit, but
say.
but you know, but I think her discussion of pariahs is really helpful here. Pariahs and parvenus, you know, and so groups who can really kind of shift in and out of certain kinds of dominant populations.
Mm-hmm.
As needed for a certain kind of ascendance, right? Which is not voluntary. And again, I think there's a paucity of vocabulary when we're describing agency, which is the focus of another research project that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean deliberate, right? But something,
it's functional.
That it's both about ascendance, about survival, and then also convenient for the dominant population to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think certain, especially over the last 15 years, as there's been a certain kind of collective racial awareness that really culminated with the election of President Obama, you know, that it's very selective.
Mm-hmm.
There's a selective way of saying, look, see, we're not racist because we've elected President Obama or, you know, even President Bush's ability to kind of deflect charges of racism by having Condoleezza Rice and Alberto Gonzalez and John Yoo, you know, architect, be the mastermind of Guantanamo and torture, So folks of color. So that you can deflect. And yet there's something very interesting. But the deflecting is literally about kind of trying to retain a certain picture of who's racist or who's not. And so, you know, it's just helpful in terms of, you know, of always creating a certain kind of ambiguity by having a population that borders the out-group and the in-group. The example that I use is about African-Americans, but I don't think that it's about them ubiquitously or permanently or in every area of society. Well, so as I point out in L.A., you know, it could be actually a discussion between, you know, about Iranians, at the same time that some subgroup of Iranians who are working class or poor recent immigrants are being interrogated, you know, rounded up and detained.
Well, I mean, I think it also can, you know, there's this longstanding phenomenon of the Uncle Tom kind of situation where even within a racial group, there are select people who perform that bordering, that bordering, bordering function. Right, so that you wouldn't even have to identify it, I think, with it, with a specific, let's say, ethnic or racial kind of group. It's really you're pointing to a kind of way in which sovereign power functions.
But here's the thing. I mean, so I'm kind of
You're hesitant. I see it.
I'm kind of pulling away from the category of Uncle Tom. First of all, because I think that the term often ends up kind of referring to people who are thought to be racially complicit. And I think, and I'm not sure that can agree with that. I mean, because I think that that also ends up kind of displacing and ignoring the element of coercion, the complex nexus of coercion and consent. That I think Arendt's discussion of Rahel Varnhagen, and
Parvenu's... Were we in the Shaila Benabib class together? Yes, I think that's right.
Yes. You know, really ends up kind of addressing in a much more complex way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would agree with that. I mean, I think your emphasis on the coercive dimension is important, and that's obviously the problem with the vocabulary of Uncle Tom, because there is this notion of collusion.
Well, in the same way that we, when we talk about people who pass for white, well, according to whom? The one drop rule is precisely that. Kind of.
And you see the same phenomenon in discussions of the Holocaust and all. And I think that's right. So what I liked about your analysis is that it really does show it focuses on the function and the, let's say, the logic of how sovereign power operates. Rather than on necessarily, I mean, it could operate in different ways in different kinds of groups,
I think that's right.
And so you don't have to identify with a specific kind of group. Well, it's really been great to have you on the Digital Dialogue.
This was fun. Thank you so much for giving me a chance to kind of chat about this stuff with you and actually just having a great philosophical conversation.
And I encourage everyone to get the book Toward a Political Philosophy of Race. And thank you for listening to the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.